For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Than whole, riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking at. Can none of y'all mirror me back? Yeah, hear me rap, it's like Angie rapping his prime. I'm young H.O. Raps great for
dead. Welcome back to another installment of Miami Nice, the podcast that is obsessed with Michael Mann's 2006 movie Miami Vice. And today I'm here with my co-host Blake Howard, and we have gotten one of our white whale guests onto the podcast. We have been talking about her article the entire time we've been recording this podcast. It is the amazing entertainment and Hollywood reporter Kim Masters, who wrote a seminal article for Slate about the production of Miami Vice. So welcome, Kim. We are so excited to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I think the white whale thing is a reference to the pandemic COVID-19 struggling with, but I'll allow it.
Oh, no, not at all. Every time we do this podcast, we say, oh, Kim's article mentioned this, and Kim's article mentioned that, and also
guests bring it up.
So, I did not know this. Legend, but okay, it's good. I'm happy to hear it.
Kim, I just want to say, firstly, thank you so much. We literally had, I don't know if it's like the Miami Nice most wanted list, but you've been at the top of it. So it's great to have you here.
How Michael Mann would feel about that.
Michael Mann and then you.
Mr. Mann has been a guest of some of our other shows. So if he ever does want to come on again and talk about Miami Vice, we'd obviously love to have him. But I guess what we've always been fascinated with in this film is the turbulence behind the scenes, and we love it. And I think what's great about your article right from the beginning is, like, if people like this movie, it's a miracle, because and I've always taken that sort of ethos with, like, if people like this movie, it's a miracle. And so many people, when they talk about it, who may not be familiar with your article, just have no clue that this entire production, the time it was being made, some of the challenges that they face that you go through and catalog in your article are kind of like insane, like levels of insane that other film productions don't have to do. And there are usually,
and then they become a story.
So please, we would love to hear from you about, especially like the gestation of the article. And we just started talking about it at the time. The article was written for Slate. You've got many bylines, obviously The Hollywood Reporter, Vanity Fair, Time, Esquire, like you've written books, but this is like a real movie story. So please, like, just tell us in the nicest possible way, please tell us absolutely everything you can remember.
I actually cannot remember exactly what got me started on, I mean, I think that at the time, maybe there were rumors. That's usually what happens. There's rumors that the productions are troubled and expensive and going over budget and maybe delayed. I can't remember if this movie was delayed, but something lights that fuse of what's going on. There's a certain amount of serendipity. Someone I know had a family member on the crew. I don't remember if that started me with the stories, but something started. And we've seen this. This is not an isolated thing. I've seen this on World War Z. It was the same thing.
Yes.
Inarritu movie, The Revenant, yes. Same thing. You start to hear about problems. And I will say, you get to a point on these productions sometimes where the crew, and sometimes the cast as well, starts to lose faith in what the director is doing, or just get mad to the point where they are really ready to talk. And that was to some degree the case with this movie. They were just so tired of what was going on with Michael Mann that they, you know, I often say it takes a lot to get your crew that disenchanted with you. You really have to be a jerk or a mess in some shape or form. I mean, you know, I think the crew on World War Z was just ready to, I mean, they kind of quietly replaced the director and shot the last third of the movie over. I think the crew was ready to just tie the guy to a chair and gag him so he would stop talking. And it happens. It happens. They just turn. And that happened on this film. And that's a bad day. And I will tell you the degree to which it happened. It's something that I really remember about this movie, this story, that is still kind of bugs me in terms of the Michael Mann of it all. You know, as you can see, he's quoted in the piece, and his publicist decided to put him on the phone with the great legendary Pat Kingsley, if memory serves. And he answered a bunch of questions. And one of the questions was about the hurricane, which was Katrina, and how certain people on the crew had said, we were uncomfortable shooting during a hurricane warning. And Michael Mann in that call said, oh, no, I didn't do that. It was a hurricane watch. And it really wasn't a warning. I mean, a watch is more like preliminary, maybe there's going to be, but it wasn't a warning. And I didn't in that moment know better. But when I went back to those sources, they were so incensed because that was a lie that they copied their pay stubs with the timestamps on them to show that they had been ordered to shoot during a hurricane watch for Hurricane Katrina. Very dangerous and not really legal. And I remember the film people, the Miami film people, tap dancing around this because they didn't want to say that this had happened. You know, they were being pressured, obviously. It was really, you know, it makes you realize the film industry's power is so great that they were willing to kind of cover up and paper over a director telling a crew to shoot during a hurricane warning, and where I think, if I'm remembering, the windows broke at one point and sort of rained down on Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx. Well, so, you know, I did go back and I tried to say, excuse me, I think you lied because I have physical proof in my hand that you lied. And of course, he's no longer available. Can't get him on the phone. You know, that kind of thing is you don't forget as a reporter. You lied to my face and you won't come back and explain that you were mistaken or come up with some excuse for what you know you did.
My God. I mean, That particular line in the article, which is we've closed a freeway down and two people are riding along with the top down in a convertible, and the windows shatter and the glass goes all over the convertible and damages the car and damages the guys. It's like
who does that?
That's insane.
And then the city, the Miami, and we can't remember if it was the city or the county, whatever, the film authority is like, yeah, no biggie, it's not a problem. What's the matter with you? Like, that could have been a major problem, obviously. I mean, I was saying to you, know, this behavior of, and Michael Mann is unapologetic in the story. He's like, yep, get on a different movie if you don't like it. And that was an ethos. You know, Jim Cameron was the same way, you know, you're tough, you know. I really hope we're moving away from that now. And you see the reaction to the reporting that my colleague at The Hollywood Reporter did on Scott Rudin and other publications have subsequently done. You know, there's a kind of a recoil from that extreme of abuse, and there should be. I mean, there's always been this thing like, yeah, they're creative, so they do this stuff. But not everybody's creative does that stuff. You know, I don't think you would see a situation where Steven Spielberg is telling people to shoot during a hurricane warning or get off the production. No. And that wasn't, you know, all of it. You know, he was recording these directions into a like stream of consciousness, and he would make errors or contradict himself. And the crew is sitting there trying to make plans. You know, these things you don't just step out onto a set and start shooting. Like, things must be put into place. And he's like saying, make it yellow, no, make it blue. And you don't know, does he want blue or does he want yellow? You know, that's inefficient. It's kind of a lot like the Scott Rudin thing. Also, we had on my show, The Business, we had three former Scott Rudin assistants, and one of them made this point, like, this constant turnover and yelling and screaming is highly inefficient. And with movies, you know, every minute is money. And so when he's saying blue, no yellow, and you don't know which one it is, you're just wasting. And he did go over budget, as is predictable. So, you know, it's up to the studio, I guess. Is it worth it? I don't know that the ultimate payday from Miami Vice was. I've never analyzed that.
Well, it's interesting, you know, mentioning that, you know, obviously you interviewed Mann. I mean, I think a lot of these articles about troubled productions or about, you know, things like this, usually the creator is not as involved in the interview process and is willing to talk about it. You know, usually it's just sort of a canned statement or some sort of release through a spokesperson. So I think it's so interesting that you did talk to him, and even though it might have been spun in a certain way, that he was quite unapologetic and circumspect about the conditions of the shooting and all the chaos that was happening, whether it was someone getting shot in the Dominican Republic or a hurricane with blasts raining onto Jamie and Colin in the Ferrari or whatever it is. I mean, I think it's interesting that he was willing to sort of go there. I mean, was that unusual for you? Were you surprised at all?
I mean, it's happened. I'll tell you, when we did the Revenant story where the crew was fed up, and he did put people in the area to put people at risk, I sort of thought he was safely off filming in Canada when I was reporting the story. Like, you know, I'll get something like that, you know. And I, to my shock, I got a call like late afternoon saying he is in LA and wants you to come to his office now. It's like, I guess that's good, but do I have to? And, you know, he felt in the same vein in a way as Michael Mann. I mean, he made a bigger effort to be charming, but he honestly thought, I could tell that I'm going to charm my way out of this with this reporter. I'm going to sit down and I'm just going to be so charming. But you can't charm your way out of half your crew getting on the phone. It's not one or two usually in these situations. It's a bunch. You've lost the crew. And that's hard to charm your way out of. And the piece came out the way it came out. Of course, the movie went on and did very well. So it doesn't, you know, one of the points I like to make with, it's because studios, I haven't done one of these stories in a while, but they get so reactive and scared and it's going to put a pall. I mean, I know that Universal then had thought that I ruined Battleship because we wrote a story sort of questioning the making of Battleship, the movie that I think by the look on your faces, you're like, what's that? It's a code.
No. Oh, no, we know. The look on our faces is because we know exactly what Battleship is.
Oh, okay. Sorry. But, you know, I often point to, like, we did a piece about Noah, the Aronofsky film, and they did not put him on the phone, but one of the studio execs sat down and really just talked through things that were going wrong. And, you know, if the movie came out and did better than I would have imagined, World War Z did fine. If the movie delivers, as I like to say to these studios, if the movie delivers, you don't have to worry about a difficult production story. That may actually increase interest, but the movie has to deliver.
Yeah, it's the most famous one, which actually now has a lot of new generation filmmakers going, I want to make my apocalypse now. And the great filmmaker Chris McQuarrie, who's a very successful now director of the Mission Impossible franchise, Chris McQuarrie says, all you have to do to make Apocalypse Now is go insane, go like a couple $100 million over budget, mortgage your house, maybe have deaths in the family, maybe have a Filipino government just, you know, pull helicopters away half through the all that's fine. Nearly kill yourself, have a heart attack, have one of your stars have a heart attack. Then you can make Apocalypse Now.
Yes,
before that, you just have to make The Godfather, The Godfather Part 2, and The Conversation, and a San Francisco opera all in sequence, and win multiple Academy Awards. Then you can do that. So I completely agree. I think sometimes these things, especially with Apocalypse Now example, that's the legend of that movie. You buy the movie now with the Hearts of Darkness documentary. That's how Francis Ford Coppola packages it. It's like, this movie is a miracle, and here's the insanity that resulted in this miracle. So, like, right. if the movie delivers, you're 100% right. Then we...
I mean, we're in such a different world now in terms of maybe an indie film, but a studio film. I mean, studio films still go awry, but... it's not... You know, we're in so much more of a corporate world that I think... they at least try to be a little bit more buttoned down. It's very hard though. It's a creative business. I mean, I'm not willing to, I'm willing to say it's not like it's not like making the perfect hamburger, you know, there's no recipe. And so you're putting yourself out there and it's stressful. I think sometimes the success that people have had, you know, even on this film with Jamie Foxx, he won an Oscar before they got into it. And he suddenly was showing up with his big entourage and having a lot of demands, some of which were perfectly reasonable, by the way. Not wanting to go to a very dangerous part of Paraguay for the final bit is, I would not have an issue with that. I mean, you know, he made them do the ending over because he wasn't going to go. He was refusing. So, but, you know, I creative people, things are going to happen. That's for sure. But I don't know. I feel like it's not quite the same. I don't know. Maybe because Marvel is such a machine, you never hear anything. You never hear anything. They somehow have it buttoned down. And it's been a while since we've really looked. I'm trying to think the last time we said, let's do a production gone haywire story. And it really has been a while.
Dante Spinotti, who is one of Michael Mann's frequent cinematographer collaborators for many, many years, spoke to the show one time, and Dante said he worked on the Ant-Man movie with Peyton Reed. I think it's Ant-Man and the Wasp, the second one. And he just said, everything's animated. Like they basically animate the whole movie
right
as their plan.
And so post-production, really.
So they animate everything, even the shots they're going to do in live action. So they kind of get a gist of where they want the cameras to look, because they're at the same, simultaneously with all of the special effects, the special effects people are built rendering backgrounds and things changing. And so he talked about it being like one of the coolest groups of people to work with, one of the most, he had the best lighting rigs, the most insane equipment he's ever had at his disposal, but it was for a very specific thing that they already knew it was basically going to happen. So there's only so much you can do. So I imagine it's like that. It's like, if you are so rigorous like Marvel, it's like there's no like that's sometimes the critical disparity on it is like there's no spontaneity. It feels like it's cooked in a lab, and then it comes out of the lab and it looks like the lab movie, and it's,
yeah, and then it grosses like $1 billion plus. So I mean, you know, Kevin Feige has made everybody else suffer by, because he has this unbelievable track record of success, and everybody, you know, certainly Warner's has had constant comparisons to their detriment, and it kills everybody. It just shows you the value of someone with that kind of vision.
Yes.
But yes, if you are, you know, we had Chloe Zhao on our show for The Rider, which was this wonderful small film.
Beautiful film.
And she was already signed to do The Eternals. And I was thinking, how is that going to go? What are you doing, Chloe? They seem to kind of want to give it a shot, you know? And certainly Ryan Coogler is probably the one who made it more his own than anybody. But yes, Marvel, it's like they seem to really know what they're doing, and they do it every time.
I think that what's interesting about Miami Vice and the trouble behind the scenes is that it feels like the production like informs the text of the film. You know, it's not like they're trying to cover it up like, oh, you know, all this bad stuff is happening, you know, there's a hurricane. It's like the air feels like there's a hurricane going on, and the barometric pressure is dropping. The word plastic keeps like coming into my mind, like the film itself was like permeable to all of these production issues, and that, you know, the ending changed because of what happened with Jamie and the shooting and all of these things. So it's like, I feel like there's the production stories where they're trying to say, oh no, this didn't happen at all. We're going to cover it up. Everything's fine. We're going to reshoot it. And then there's this film, which is like kind of embracing the messiness in a way. And it lends to the air of like danger and chaos that I think this film sort of, we love that aspect of this movie, that it feels affected by the environment and the circumstances under which they were shooting, and that it feels palpable. So it's interesting that it's like the troubled production and the text itself are like sort of interlocked in a way that other troubled production stories or films that had troubled productions might not be in the same way.
You know, I'll tell you, you may lose all respect for me, but the dirty little secret is I have never seen Miami Vice.
We've got to watch it.
Well, we've got to watch it. You've got to watch it for us. It's an excellent, we spent lots of time talking about it. It's an excellent movie. And there is things like, for example, you talk about Chloe Zhao with The Rider, something that I know you would have seen. There are things in that movie that she's just capturing sunsets and people like stalking across hillscapes, and you're just like these rolling dales of people on a horse, and it's just magisterial. Miami Vice has the inverse of that, what Katie's talking about. It's like really hostile people, and in the background, a storm front that's like bubbling and simmering, yes, like toffee in a pot. And you're like, that's not a fake storm. That's Hurricane that's Katrina, right? So, like, so there
a minor
is
a little hurricane.
So there is just that. That's what this movie had. There's a secret sauce that you can't fake sometimes. Yeah, but
I don't think you can make the movie. I like to think that you don't have to endanger your crew and torture your people.
No, just to qualify, we're not saying that. just that, you know, to exactly your point, sometimes when the movie comes out, for a certain group of fans at the time, immediate people were immediate adopters, and then it has had a long tail. Like, it has had this continual reappraisal. And that's part of what our show is doing, is just reappraising this thing over.
Yes. Well, that's what the studio said at the time.
Yeah.
I've never analyzed it. Like, I don't know where it is on Rotten Tomatoes or what the ultimate box office of it was. So I don't know.
I will say that on film Twitter, especially in the past couple of years, like, it's definitely had like a cult resurgence. Like, I keep seeing more and more people tweeting about Miami Vice.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Past couple of years, and so it's almost become a cult movie. Like, I'm not totally sure if it was considered that successful, because yeah, they were hoping for, you know, like DVD Blu-ray sales after it came out, and I'm not sure even if it was a success in home entertainment. But about 15 years later, it's kind of, you know, gaining some cult status, or maybe that's just the people that I follow on Twitter.
Well, maybe so. Yeah. I don't remember seeing it, but it's, there are a lot of Michael Mann fans out there. So probably, right, you know, they're looking at it, and I don't know. I wrote about it, and I don't remember it getting such good reviews that I felt like, oh yes, I have to go watch Miami Vice. But it may have had a long tail. I don't know. I mean, nowadays, that's another thing that we're seeing the end of, is, you know, the studios pushing everything towards streaming, which I think is a very dangerous game that they're playing, but they choose to play it now. They're obsessed with their streamers, and they are sacrificing things that could be sold in multiple markets for many millions of dollars. And that's, is it worth it? Well, I think people are going to get hurt.
Interesting.
There were filmmakers who got to make a lot of films in the late 90s and early 2000s that film studios almost accepted were not going to make money at the theater, and accepted that in home entertainment and international releases, that's where they'd recoup their immediate budget. And then therefore the tail of that potential, you know, sale to television stations and all those sort of things would be factored into the long,
all the many, time, many windows. Yeah. The windows. TV and, yeah, you know, free TV and the airplane and the hotel room, all of these things that throw off money. You know, when you put things day and date, we're still in a very experimental moment where if you put it to the streamer and you know, movie theaters aren't completely open now. So we're in this weird phase, but certainly if you're Chris Nolan, you think this is a very bad business decision. And he is not alone in that respect. He's obviously a big theater booster, but he also makes a business argument. That a lot of people think, you know, you're taking your life in your hands when you put everything on a streamer, and the streamers are under pressure to constantly produce fresh content to keep you from churning out of your subscription. So if you're going to put all your movies on that and strangle movie theaters because they're not enough, you don't have enough exclusive product. And we're seeing this drama play out in real time. It's just playing out with Quiet Place 2, where, you know.
Yeah, I was just going to mention the Paramount versus Emily Blunt and John Krasinski at the moment, because so much of their incentivized pay packets, they probably took a significant took significantly less, is now in jeopardy, because if they put it day and date onto a Paramount Plus or something like that, or earlier, then...
But I mean, they have said it's a 45-day window, but it's, I don't think the rules are so clear. Like, is it really 45 exclusive days, or can they pull it out early if it somehow falters? And, you know, so, and I, you know, I think it's a little simple, because it's almost more, it's not so much Paramount. I think Paramount actually does want to protect the theatrical window, and is having more pressure from inside. Like, can't we put it on Paramount Plus? We need to goose this thing. It's kind of the also ran. Can't we just get some heat on that? And I think, you know, the studio is in the, squeezed in the middle, trying to protect and preserve theaters and keep up relationships with talent like John Krasinski, and at the same time placate their owners and their masters. Tough time in the movie business, for sure.
Really tough. Two things, because we just talked about it. Miami Vice grossed $164 million worldwide on the budget of
that's not going to cut it.
That's not going to cut it, because the official budget was $135 million, but according to Kim's great article, it's like north of $150 million.
And don't forget the tens of millions they spent on marketing also. That's something people tend to forget.
And it's still got a 46 on Rotten Tomatoes.
And now you know why.
46. That's a travesty.
That's wild.
That is a travesty.
But
I mean, what's more telling, Katie, and I rarely check this, but like, there's a 43% for audience. So audiences are still soft on it. And I'm like,
oh, wow.
That turned around. That's a funny one.
I think Michael Mann hurt himself with that Miami Vice display. I really do. I mean, I haven't looked at his IMDb page to remember it afterwards, but did he get another big movie? I can't remember.
Public Enemies came after, and there was apparently friction between him and Depp during the production of Public Enemies. That's sort of
shocking.
I wish I had a GIF of Kim's face. Shocking. I want that to tweet to people who tell me obvious things from now on. Oh my god, that was amazing. So apparently it was that, but there's not a version of your story that is so clinical that says this is accounts from the crew that this was the challenge. It's just sort of in the ether. And then after that. After Public Enemies is Black Hat with Chris Hemsworth. There were all three of them that were Universal Pictures. And then with Black Hat, that was one that was sort of dead on arrival from the studio. The studio were just like, overwhelmingly were like, this is barely going to get a release in the States. It was Chris Hemsworth, who's Australia's biggest movie star right now. It was coming to Australia to get a premiere with Michael Mann and everything in tow. And Universal went, nope, and just killed
it. Thank you.
It's not gonna happen. So yeah, that one since then, it's kind of those three films with Universal, it's been lots of kickstarts, and then
a couple of things happen, right? That first of all, people say life is too short. That happened with Scott Rudin, who does business with A24, but the studios got fed up with him. I think back when he did The Hours in like 2003, it was like, Jesus Christ, you are so high maintenance and your movies aren't that commercial and we're just not doing it.
Yeah.
And they lost interest in the more adult type of movie, that kind of scripted stuff that they don't do so much, became all about these comic book things and superhero things. So you see a combination of factors, I think. And then there's a thing with directors, you know, not that many directors can maintain, you know, you remember Barry Levinson was rolling along for years and then it just kind of stopped, you know. Steven Spielberg he's had some hits and misses, but he has been certainly in terms of longevity, it's been pretty amazing. But that's exceptional. I feel like directors, I don't know whether it's a question of just, you know, they're not so in sync with the zeitgeist anymore, or they're a step slower or whatever, but it's very hard to sustain over years, I think, that kind of career as a director. He had a look and a feel that was very hot, and then it became different. The movie stopped working. Was it him? Was it the world? I don't know.
I'm curious about, I noted rereading your article that you mentioned that Mann and Jamie Foxx were going to do The Kingdom, and you were basically saying, here's this really troubled production, and Jamie Foxx, you know, left, and he, you know, changed the ending, but they're actually going to work together again. And then Peter Berg ended up directing The Kingdom, and I know Mann produced, but I'm like, I wonder if there's a story there. I was trying to find
it could be, I don't know, but it could be as simple as, I mean, it could be any number of explanations. There may be a story there. It may be that Jamie didn't want to work with him. It may be that he didn't want to work with Jamie. It may be that he got something else he wanted to do, but it's just, it feels like that didn't happen. A lot of things don't happen in Hollywood.
Right. I mean, you know, it just could be one thing. Oh, you know, we're going to have Peter Berg do this instead or whatever happened. Maybe nothing dramatic at all. But I was like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what happened there.
I mean, if I'm Jamie Foxx and somebody is shot right outside the gates of where I'm shooting, because I'm in a place where the security wasn't handled properly. And then you're asking me to go risk my neck. And you know, Jamie has his own issues. Apparently he's scared of planes and trains and I don't know, whatever.
I love that he's scared of planes and boats, and he spends like a third of this movie in planes and boats. Literally driving planes and boats. Flying.
And I can feel that I can relate to those anxieties, especially where the prep might have been a little bit like, are you changing your mind about something that's now going to make this unsafe? So he may not have wanted to put himself in Michael Mann's hands anymore. You know, I don't know. He might have said, forget it. I never followed up to find out.
Kim, can I just say one thing that I want to just recommend to everyone listening? Firstly, is obviously to read this article and continue following you in the business. But there's just one thing that I love doing, and this is a really perverse thing that I want to recommend, is reading your terrific article and then going and finding on YouTube the canned like junket interviews where lots of people are like, so you guys have done Miami Vice, are you going to do another one? And watching the quality of the acting between Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx trying to be like, yeah, of course, we'd love to work together again. This was a blast. Michael Mann is excellent. I love, like, I don't want anyone for a second to think that Katie and I don't love this movie. We love it. And sometimes the reality is stranger than fiction behind the scenes of making movies. So I just want to just put it out there. But man, I love that. Because you just know, like, no, this movie was chaos. And part of that real chaos, whatever intangible quality that has, is in the movie. Does it make all movies great? Absolutely not. But is it evident in this movie? It does. And I love reading your article, hearing about all this chaos, and then watching them just do a normal junket popcorn daytime TV interview. It just tickles me.
It always amazes me that you can write an article like that, like mine, and then no one at the junket dares to say dude, come on, ask a question. Come on, be brave. Just ask. You can say that other bad person wrote about this, so I have to ask you because my boss told me I do. But just go ahead, just stick your little neck out, but don't do it.
There's a lot of scary publicists staring daggers at you saying, don't ask any questions.
Never bother. I just am like, get out of my studio.
What is your favorite line from the article? And then I'll share my favorite line from the article.
That is a great
You're not
point.
Asking. No.
Do not have Kim, favorite. You can also share your favorite line from the article. No, we're just fanboying and fangirling.
I sent it to my editor and was done. That's my favorite part.
You're like turning it in, being done.
Being done is my favorite.
My own boss used to say, finished is better than good.
Exactly. That's how I live my life as well.
My absolute favorite, and will actually be the title of this episode, The Sound of Silence. My favorite line in Kim's wonderful article is, asked about Fox's departure, Mann doesn't speak for a moment, and then he says, you hear the sound of silence? I love it.
Science. It's like,
love it so much. So much. Katie?
Okay, so mine has to do with Hurricane Wilma, which, okay, if Hurricane Katrina was threatening the production and then they get all the way to Hurricane Wilma, like, they name them alphabetically. That means there were a lot of hurricanes.
Yes.
In between Katrina and Wilma.
Wow.
Yeah. Having grown up in hurricane land, I'm like familiar with how they do this. But so Hurricane Wilma struck Miami, heavily damaging the production office. And then it says, and the power was out, the city was dark. High-level studio insiders says this is where Mann's personality actually paid off. were it not for his insanity, his dedication, his knowledge as a producer, we would have been shut down. So I just feel like there's so much in that sentence. Like, yes, it was insane, but he was also dedicated and he did know what he was doing. Yes, we were just, you know, our production office was just taken out by a hurricane, but we managed to pull something off.
With a W hurricane. Yeah. And there were multiple quotes throughout where it's just kind of like the studio is somewhat surrendering, but like, yes, it was insane, but yeah. You know, we're going to make money eventually.
Maybe at some point.
They're not going all the way to the lie about it was great and we're rich. They're just kind of like, yeah, maybe it might work out. It was crazy, but that might've been good.
Later in the paragraph, I think the same studio executive says, but for Michael's indomitable bullheadedness, it would have been much worse. Oh, and God. So it's
the greatest.
But we needed that.
it's just a chorus line of like backhanded compliments. Like it was right. Insane, but he's bullheaded,
because they know at that point they're probably heading for a loss and a problem on their balance sheet, and they're being asked to defend the damn thing when this guy's undoubtedly driven them crazy and tortured them and caused problems with their talent. And so they're trying to grit their teeth and say, "Yeah, it was not a complete disaster."
So I think what I love about this article is that everyone seems very honest in it, and sometimes you can read these articles where it feels like spin. Or people are defending things or not sharing things. And like that might have been the case when you were, you know, obviously you said he lied about the hurricane warning versus the hurricane watch. But what comes out in the piece that you actually wrote feels very real. And so I think that is what we love so much about reading it. That it feels.
What you have to do as a reporter is know you're right or believe that you're right. You know, you have to be able to, because they will say that's not true. And, you know, I will sometimes say, is that what you're going to say? Is that your final word? Because I think you're not, you know, it's not, I know I'm right. And then they kind of go, let me.
I just want to say this, Kim, I love you. That's so great. Is that your, interesting. Is that your take? Is that where we're going with this? I just love.
Into that bit because bit is not going to work in this piece, but you can lie and share the world if you want to. So yes, gosh. I think maybe that's why they were a little more candid. They knew that I knew.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, the examples that we kicked off our entire conversation and the impulse is you can have disgruntled individuals on sets and sometimes they're more toxic. Like you can feel a toxicity of like you hear a report of an actor not getting on with the director individually, but the rest of the film has a cohesion. But like you said, when you're getting half the crew, like World War Z, exactly. Like turning up, calling you, like, hey, I'm ready to talk. You don't even have an article ready. You're like, okay, I better start typing, start recording this conversation. That's a completely different animal. So, yeah, for example, you know, in this case, and, you know, Katie and I have talked about it recently for other things, but it was just like, I also imagine if you're working with a crew who lives in Florida and there is a hurricane, we've just gone through a pandemic. There's potentially people's families are in danger or hometowns are in danger. And there's a whole air of compassion that probably needs to be laid over that lens, like a compassionate lens. Like we're all working here. We know that we just don't want this thing to shut down because we don't want it to get away from us or whatever, or blow out or the studio to Cannes. So we're going to take it to the limit in the parlance of this movie. But you can totally understand people being less inclined for BS if they've got family in danger or their hometown's in danger or it's underwater or whatever.
They were really mad. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing for crew to send you their pay stubs. You know, they were really, really mad.
Yeah.
And they should have been. I think they were completely right. There's no excuse. It's no excuse. I'm sorry. For your movie, you're going to do that to people? It's not okay.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Sometimes I have to just say to myself, you know, in this world that we live in, like, it's just movies. You know, in the industry that we work in everything, we take it very seriously and it's very important. There's a lot on the line, but it's just a movie.
At the end of the day. Risking lives. I mean, we're at a turning point in the industry where you're going to get called out. I feel like, you know, people are emboldened now. And a lot of these younger people who are Gen Z, they're not there for it. You know, they're like, if you listen to the episode we did with Scott Rudin's assistants, you know, they're like, what is this crap? You know, they all got to that point and they're on the record. They're talking publicly with their actual names, which it's not like news that Scott Rudin was an abusive nightmare. It's, I wrote about it in 2003 and Swinging Sharks is before that in the 90s. Everybody knew. It was more open of a secret than Harvey Weinstein. And yet only in this moment is it a thing. And I hope that means something. You know, I hope that if a Michael Mann type of director decides to start doing this to people, they will be on the phone fast to the press and blow the whistle.
Yeah.
You know, we protect them. I mean, nobody got outed as a source on this thing. We're careful with people's careers.
You're not putting them in a hurricane. You're protecting their quotes.
And I mean, you know, it would not help. Like a lot of people put their career in your hands with, they have an NDA, whatever. We don't take that lightly. I mean, I certainly don't. I always tell people, know your reporter. Don't call somebody you don't feel you can trust, who doesn't have a good reputation. Yeah. But we take it very, very seriously. If you're going to come to us with a story, we're going to protect you no matter what.
Well, thank you, Kim. This was an awesome conversation. So, so interesting and like a lot to chew over. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, because this was just awesome.
It was my pleasure. I'm glad we got to do it.
Indeed.
Just a brilliant chat. Thank you, Kim. And just one thing, we just hope that you just check in with us once you actually, if ever, see Miami Vice.
that 40-something percent on both audience and critics is a very compelling argument. I will... You know, when we have a guest on the show, we watch them, we feel like we have to watch at least most, or, you know, and there are times when I'm like, give me strength. And there are times I'm genuinely happy when I like something so that I don't have to be scared that, you know, they'll say, well, what did you think? And I'm the terrible liar. So I'm like, look over there.
This podcast is here to erase the 46% on Rotten Tomatoes. Be time. And trust us. Okay. And also watch the theatrical cut.
Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.